Hello, I'm John Zipperer, the host of the Commonwealth Club's week-to-week political roundtable. You can find out more about week-to-week, including how to attend a program when you're in the Bay Area, and all about our nearly 500 programs a year at commonwealthclub.org. Now, let's join today's program. Well, coming to you from the Toby Family Auditorium at the Commonwealth Club, it's the week-to-week political roundtable for Monday, August 27th, 2018. Welcome, everyone. Now, California Congressman Duncan Hunter is in hot water over misuse of campaign funds. We've all heard this, heard about his extravagant lifestyle of parties and vacations and more, even spending $600 to fly the family's pet rabbit during a vacation. GOP consultant Rob Stutzman tweeted, "The most overlooked similarity between the Trump and Hunter cases may be that they both apparently made illegal payments related to bunnies." Well, GOP consultants have all the good jokes. I'm John Zipperer, your host for tonight's program and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. And on today's program, we are going to discuss the significant developments last week in the president's legal and political standing. We're also going to discuss Jeff Sessions, John McCain, Bart, and more. And of course, we'll end the evening with our live news quiz. Now, it doesn't matter where you fall on the political spectrum. Everyone's welcome at the Commonwealth Club. So any opinions expressed here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club, unless I agree with them. So let's meet our panelists for tonight. I'll start on the far end of the stage with Dan Schnurr. He's a professor at the University of California, the University of Southern California, Annenberg School of Communications, as well as the UC Berkeley Institute of Governmental Studies. He's on Twitter at Dan Schnurr. So welcome back, Dan. Joining our panel for the first time is Guy Marzorati. He's a politics reporter at KQED News, and he's on Twitter at Guy Marzorati. So, Guy, welcome to the panel. And next to me is Barbara Marshman, former editorial pages editor of the Mercury News, and you can follow her on Twitter at Barb Marshman. So welcome back. There are question cards spread throughout the room. I think you all know how we do this. Write down some questions. People will pick them up, deliver them to me, and I'll try to ask as many as I can during our program today. Now, I wanted to start with the news over the weekend. Arizona Senator John McCain passed away just one day after ending most treatment for his brain cancer. Dan, you knew the senator. So what sort of a man was he?
Well, I should be clear at the outset. I served as the National Communications Director for Senator McCain's presidential campaign in the year 2000 when he unsuccessfully sought the Republican nomination. And so I should tell you that I knew John McCain for a short time, a long time ago, and I don't want to overstate the extent of that relationship, but clearly he's somebody I hold in very high regard. Otherwise, I would not have moved across country to work for him. I'd offer you just two quick thoughts on him. One, what struck me when I met with him for the first time about that campaign in the early months of 1999, I was just telling you guys a little bit about it. What struck me about that conversation is how disinterested he seemed in talking about the machinations of a presidential campaign, Iowa, New Hampshire, and the rest of it, and how much he was focused on using that campaign as a platform from which to talk about the need for campaign finance reform. And although the campaign ended up achieving some short-term and intermittent successes along the way, I wouldn't suggest for a moment that he didn't want to be president, that he wasn't running without regard to winning. But it was very clear to me from that first meeting that the primary reason, motivation for his campaign had less to do with him being elected and more to do with building awareness and support for the kind of comprehensive reform that he and Senator Feingold ultimately achieved a couple years later. And the other thing I'd offer, and then we can move on with the conversation, is I obviously did not know him during the time that he was held in North Vietnam, and so I can't speak with any authority about that time whatsoever, except for about the week I spent at the Pensacola Naval Station going through his medical records and learning just some absolutely horrific things. But I would offer you this. People would frame his temperament in a positive way as an ebullient so-called happy warrior, and in a less flattering way as a very occasionally bad-tempered, foul-tempered individual. And however you characterize it, what struck me about John McCain is what an impatient person he was. And I had never spent any time in a prison camp, certainly not 5.5 years, but the way I interpreted it is after 5.5 years of having his life taken away from him, the idea of being patient to accomplish anything was just unacceptable to him. And there were times when that was a very joyful experience and times when it was a much more confrontational one. And I believe that that also, yeah, he was obviously a very outgoing, ebullient, interactive individual with friends and foes. I would imagine that 5.5 years of captivity, a large amount of that in solitary confinement, makes someone not just appreciate, but almost hunger for personal interaction. And as I watched him on the campaign trail that year, those are the two conclusions I came to, informed or not, about how that ordeal shaped him as a public and political persona.
And Barbara, you, I assume he came to your editorial board when he was running, and he had two campaigns.
He did in 2000. I'm not sure. I don't think he did in 08, because we'd have said a few words about Sarah Palin, I think. But pre-Sarah Palin, I've been off the editorial board out of journalism more or less for about 6 months now. But I will continue to use the editorial we because I've done it my whole life and I can't stop myself. We interviewed him in 2000, and we're a moderate to liberal progressive group, but occasionally recommended Republicans. I don't think we were close to recommending John McCain for president, but we definitely liked him as the nominee, and in the primary recommended him. And it's funny you should say, Dan, that he wanted to engage issues when some people you remember as being very focused and very into messaging, into the campaign. And that is not what I remember from John McCain. John McCain was a guy who wanted to talk about stuff. He just wanted to listen to us a little bit and tell us what he thought. And he was a very engaging man. And
I'll just say this. Try being communications director for somebody who doesn't believe in message discipline.
Right. Well, I was going to say, from a journalistic perspective, I mean, just the idea of the Straight Talk Express, bringing reporters onto the bus, talking openly with them, sometimes planning campaign events and financing on the bus. You dream of that today. I mean, we struggle in this age to get two gubernatorial candidates to debate more than once. We, you know, in the kind of rehearsed press release era of political journalism, I think we would long for candidates like that who were so open with the press.
Yeah, John, I know we have quite a bit to cover, but since Guy raised the Straight Talk Express, I will make an admission to those of you in the room and everywhere else. The Straight Talk Express, the campaign bus on which the senator traveled and sat with the press, not on an intermittent basis, but on a nonstop basis, or all day, every day for the entire campaign. I should admit this to you. The Straight Talk Express was an accident. John McCain didn't say, on principle, I want to spend all this time with news media. Huh. And we, as his brilliant strategists, didn't say, oh, what an extraordinary opportunity to get our message out in an unconventional way. It happened by accident. And I'll tell you how. For many months, the campaign struggled. When I went to work for him, McCain used to like to joke. He would say, I'm at 3% in the polls with a 5% margin of error. And what that meant, as these two can both tell you, is when you're at 3% in the polls, there's not a lot of reporters who want to spend time with you. Yeah. So we would travel by rent-a-car or a volunteer driving us, or if we had really had a good fundraising day, taxi. And if a reporter happened to be traveling with us, that reporter would sit in the front seat next to the driver, whether the volunteer or the cabbie or me, and McCain would sit in the back. That's how we'd separate them to achieve message control. And he would talk and talk and talk, and they would talk and talk and talk, and he got used to it. Then the campaign built up some steam, and we graduated to a van with 6 seats in it. Same thing. If we're lucky enough to have a couple of journalists with us, he sat and he talked for as long as they wanted to. And then on Veterans Day, Veterans Day 1999, we were in New Hampshire, and it was the first time there was enough press interest, enough media interest, to have a bus. And we got very, very excited, just that there was that much interest in the campaign. And a volunteer, a New Hampshire volunteer, no high-paid strategist or medium-paid strategist, came up with the idea. A local volunteer in New Hampshire painted the sign Stray Talk Express. Huh. Slapped it on the side of the bus. John McCain gets on the bus, and these buses are set up the same way all campaign buses or campaign planes are. You put the press in the back. There's sort of a Maginot line that separates them from the rest of us. Then in the middle, you have the volunteers and the junior staff who are sort of the DMZ. And then in the front of the bus or the plane, you have the candidate and the senior staff, and that's how you establish some protection. You guys have both seen this. So there we are in Manchester, New Hampshire. We've got the press in the back where you belong. Got all the young, earnest kids in the middle blocking. And then all of us self-important people sitting in front. And John McCain gets on the bus and walks right past all of us. Yeah. Walks past all the earnest young kids and sits down in the back of the bus with the reporters.
Your worst nightmare.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, and again, not out of his strategy, but this is what he had been doing for the past several months.
Right.
And all of us in the front of the bus look at each other in panic. And someone says to me, Schnur, you're the communications guy. Go get him out of there. I'm like, why me? I walked to the back of the bus, and I said, Senator, wouldn't you want to come up front and sit with us, you know, us important people? He says, no. I said, well, why not? And I'll never forget what he said then. He said, because you're boring, Danny. And we thought that he would sit back there for the next hour or so, and then after the next campaign stop, he'd come to the front. Huh? We thought he'd sit back there until lunchtime, and then after noon, he'd come to the front. And we waited for him to come to the front of the bus for the next year, and it just never happened. So that was the Stray Talk Express.
That's great. Well, before we exit this, out of his long career, all the things he's done, all the controversies he's been involved in, all the issues he took on, all the things he did like that, what do you think he will be remembered for 10, 20 years from now? Anyone?
I think the no ma'am moment in his town hall during the 08 campaign, stopping supporter of his who was describing then-candidate Obama as an Arab, I think that kind of showed that he viewed these elections as a little more than just his own self-interest, his own campaign. He viewed the larger effect it would have on our democracy. You know, that was a moment that you would, and I guess in 2018, you would think, you wouldn't think of many candidates who would make that move. So it would stand out to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyone?
The Obamacare vote, certainly for me, will stand out as a principled moment. But I agree that Obama incident was...
And John, briefly, I'll offer something a little bit less stark, because those are both two extraordinary moments. Mm-hmm. Look, politics doesn't come with on-off switches. It is dimmer switches. These things happen gradually. And the idea that he was the last of the great lions, I think, is a little bit much, because changes in American politics happen gradually. But I do think if you look at his career, whether it was Russ Feingold on campaign finance reform, whether it was Senator Ted Kennedy on healthcare policy, if you go all the way back to the very beginning of his post-captivity political career when he worked as a Navy staffer on Capitol Hill, his mentor was Democratic Senator Scoop Jackson of Washington State. Mm-hmm. And I think if there is something to be taken away from his career, he was not a moderate. He's a very staunch, in some ways very traditional conservative, but who did find ways to work across party lines in a way that is decidedly not the case in American politics today.
That's a good point. I think you could say the same thing about Bob Dole. You know, very partisan Republican conservative, but not only would work across the aisle, believed it was absolutely crucial to the functioning of the Senate.
And I know we have to move on, but... the year after the 2000 campaign, he and Senator Feingold came to the Commonwealth Club.
That's right.
To campaign on behalf of campaign finance reform. And John and Gloria and their amazing team here were good enough not only to invite me to attend, but to bring my students, my class from the University of California, Berkeley. and while bringing 65 students was a little bit much, about 25 of the students did come. Not only not seats, but good seats. And we'd arrange for afterwards for the senator to come by and say hello to them. We budgeted about 10 minutes in his schedule for him to come by and introduce himself and say hi. And he came in with Senator Feingold and explained to the students, he said, "You're from Berkeley? I brought Feingold because I thought he could talk some sense into you little Bolsheviks." And the two of them spent, on a time budgeted 10 or 15 minute stop, spent an hour and a half with 25 University of California Berkeley undergrads, not just to talk to them about campaign finance reform, but to make sure that every young man and every young woman in that room had a chance to ask the question that they wanted to. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, let us go to, I guess, last week when everything happened, and everything happened to Donald Trump. Let's just run down some of these things. Okay, so former campaign chief Paul Manafort was convicted of 8 of 18 charges. Trump's former lawyer Michael Cohen pled guilty to crimes and is cooperating with the prosecution. Immunity was granted to National Enquirer head and, I guess now, former Trump friend David Pecker, as well as the CFO of the Trump Organization. The Trump-endorsing representative Duncan Hunter, as we already mentioned, he and his wife were charged with campaign spending violations. And to top it all off, economic advisor Larry Kudlow was found to have invited the publisher of White Nationalists to dinner. So, Guy, from all of that, is it possible to pick what was most consequential last week?
Well, the litany. I think politically, I think that Duncan Hunter, the indictment not only hits closest to home here, but I think is actually something Democrats here are, I guess, excited to run on in these close congressional races. You know, we had Nancy Pelosi came by KQED last week and said that she's been advising Democratic candidates not to even mention Trump's name on the campaign trail. Not sure, how great advice that is, but I think it does speak to the fact that adding a sitting Congress member now to the first two to endorse Trump, into this cycle of corruption or painting of corruption that Democrats are hoping to run on, it definitely adds more substance. And also because I think campaign finance charges, it can be a very murky area, as we talked about with the Michael Cohen plea. But, when you look at the Duncan Hunter indictment, it's not. There's, I think, the only thing fuzzy about that is maybe the rabbit he was flying around the country. The indictment lists from head to toe everything him and his wife were spending campaign contributions on. So I think if Democrats, A, want to run on corruption as an issue cleaning up Washington, and B, don't want to tie everything back to Trump, the Duncan Hunter indictment plays perfectly into that.
Barbara, what about you? What do you think? Was this as unusual a week as it seemed, or was this just...
Oh, it was a very unusual week. But an awful lot of it was the potential of it all. Mm-hmm. The people that we learned were going to be or are talking with Mueller. The Manafort conviction was significant since the lead juror came out and said only one person kept them from convicting on all counts. At the same time, I was surprised Saturday evening we spent with some old friends, for Joanne Jacobs, some of you may have read when she was a columnist at the Mercury News. And she, of course, is not a Trump person. But she said she hears a lot that the stuff about Cohen brokering payments to women Trump had affairs with, everybody knew Trump had affairs, and that's really not resonating with people. Manafort, I don't know. We'll see what happens next. But these other guys that are turning, if Mueller really is trying to go after Trump in some way, I think we might look back at this as the most significant week in quite some time.
Yeah. This, like many of its predecessors, is the most significant and unusual and extraordinary week until the next one.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you that within a matter of weeks, and I don't know if it'll be 2 weeks or 10 weeks, but in the not too distant future, we will look back at the last week of August 2018 and realize that it wasn't nearly as remarkable as we thought it was, that there's just this ongoing trajectory of extraordinary niciousness. But I would offer you this to take a step back. Mm-hmm. As all of you know, impeachment is not illegal, but rather a political process. And therefore, to me, at least in the short to medium term, long term is a different discussion, the most important impact of the events that you just outlined, John, is their impact on the November midterm elections. Right. And as all of you know, as people who follow politics, presidential elections are about persuasion, midterm elections are about motivation. There are very few conservative Republicans who will vote for a progressive Democratic candidate for Congress, any more than there were a great number of Sanders supporters who had voted for a Republican in the fall of 2016. But if they're demotivated and they're discouraged, they don't vote. And the real challenge for Trump and the Republican congressional leadership is to find a way to continue to motivate the Republican base, even in the face of all these extraordinary events and equally extraordinary headlines.
But isn't his popularity within the Republican Party, within the remaining people still registered Republican, still pretty high?
There's 87%.
In midterm elections in particular, much more than presidential elections, you try to measure intensity rather than quantity. Mm. And while the overall numbers are, as John correctly pointed out, still very high, if you dig deeper into those numbers, registered Republicans, particularly female Republicans, still indicate that they support him as part of that 80-something percent, but with a much lower level of enthusiasm than they did some months ago or last year.
And I think, too, I mean, we talked a bit about this earlier. I think Trump's supporters are a unique base. Look at them more as a fan base rather than a traditional political base, in the same way that you would associate a pop star's fan base and not abandoning them based off of any event they see in the news. Duncan Hunter does not have a fan base of that ilk, or these congressional candidates in the seven swing districts don't. So I think that's where if Democrats can start to paint the corruption as wider as outside of Trump, they're going to hit candidates who don't have a fan base like Trump, who's not going to be on the ballot in November.
And it's a great point, Guy, and I broaden it because, of course, Barack Obama and the congressional Democrats learned the same lesson in his two midterm elections.
Yep.
So in a remark that ricocheted around the media sphere last week, Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani made a comment that reminded us of Pontius Pilate's famous query, "What is truth?" Rudy, talking about the difficulty of Trump getting his story straight in a meeting with Robert Mueller, said, "Truth is not truth." So truth is not truth, such as the statement. Rudy Giuliani is a great lawyer. Dan, what is Trump's legal strategy right now? Or because it's impeachment is a political thing, he doesn't have a legal strategy so much as a media and public relations strategy. Is that going too far?
No, I think that's exactly right. Yeah. Since none of us in this room, maybe Guy, but the rest of us have no idea what's actually, in the Trump tax returns and the other information that hasn't come out. Yeah. We can't know. None of us know where this heads legally. But your point, John, is exactly the right one. The way the president thinks about it, whether specifically or whether consciously or intuitively, is that if he can win the political and media war, at least for the most important target audiences that he mm-hmm. needs, that might not eliminate the legal threat, but offer some protection from it.
Yeah.
And Giuliani is clearly not a choice as a courtroom lawyer. He's clearly there to...
He might be attorney general in 3 weeks, but
it's true. It's true.
To that in a moment.
Oh my God!
You might be attorney general.
Well, this past weekend, the Financial Times had a big article on Trump's political and legal woes. One person quoted in the article compared this president to the last president who faced a special prosecutor and possible impeachment. That was of course Bill Clinton. And this person said that Clinton had the best lawyers and faced an incompetent prosecutor, and of course was ultimately not removed from office, whereas Trump seems to have inept lawyers and is facing the best prosecutor in the country. Barbara, do you think that's a fair comparison?
I think it is. I mean, Mueller really seems to be extraordinary, but if the move to get rid of, I mean, who would have thought 6 months ago that Jeff Sessions would be our hero standing between, but if, you know, if Sessions were gone, I mean, Mueller is not invulnerable, but I absolutely agree. He's extraordinary. He doesn't get into the political realm, though, and I'm not sure, without having enough on Trump to turn people against him, how he advances on Trump. He may file charges against the kids, which is to say the staff. But I'm not sure with the Republican Party or Republicans in Congress and in the Senate so defensive of Trump no matter what, I do wonder how far Mueller can get.
I think that's a great point, Barbara. When Mueller first let it be known that he did not believe that indicting a sitting president of the United States was appropriate, the way I interpreted that is, I will indict every single other person with even the slightest bit of involvement, except for the president. But that's
But I think it's interesting too that the last impeachment proceedings are recent enough that you have many, and this is actually, I think, a danger for Democrats running on this issue. You have so many Democrats, starting with the possible House Judiciary Chairman, Gerald Nadler, on down, on record in the late 90s, talking about how, you know, covering up a sex crime should not be grounds for impeachment. Those are going to be the same Democrats who, if they take back the House, would be in charge of running an impeachment proceeding. So I think that's the danger politically in pushing the impeachment issue as the top issue of the midterms.
But I think Russia has to be the issue for impeachment. I mean, it's true. Everyone knew women about Trump and any woman he can get his hands on, I guess. So I don't think that. I don't think they'd ever pull that again, especially since Clinton ultimately was not removed from office.
Yeah, and I would just add to that to make this very, very, very not fearless prediction. That because Mueller is pursuing a legal project, mm-hmm. and because impeachment, as we talked about earlier, is a political one, I would predict that regardless of what the investigation finds, under a Democratic House, Donald Trump will be impeached. Yeah. And regardless of what the investigation finds or doesn't find, under a Republican House, he will not.
Yeah.
And a Senate that does not have an overwhelming number of Democrats in it, even if they do somehow capture the majority, which is not likely, will not convict. Kind of brings the question. Someone who in the audience writes, in the age of immediate gratification, it's difficult to communicate the significance of the incremental progress in Mueller's investigation to young people. How would you frame the importance of these developments to those who don't believe Trump will face any consequences for his action? They want something now.
Hmm. I mean, I would say even more than the constant need for immediate gratification, I think the difficulty is the just overwhelming number of events that are involved in this, this investigation in Russia. There are just so many dots on the timeline that I think in many ways this would be an easier case to make to the public if it was just, you know, Trump Jr.'s meeting with the Russians involving information on N. Clinton. The fact that there are so many events from a media perspective, it's hard to, you know, keep track and keep your audience on track of all the stuff that's happening. But also, yeah, definitely, if you're just a common person following this, I think it would be a lot easier if there was that one meeting you could point to rather than the endless number of different events we deal with now.
There is a certain amount of fatigue, and it's hard to know, being somewhat outside the media now. I look at it and I think, well, why aren't they doing this? Why aren't they doing that? But I understand that you have to watch just overload and writing things people won't read.
But that's the real threat that Mueller presents to Trump. He doesn't care if young people or old people look up from their smartphones enough to watch him every day. He is going to finish this whether the American public is paying attention or not. And when he does, depending on what he's accomplished, that is going to bring their attention back, even if it didn't maintain throughout.
Well, one person who's a key player, or in Trump's mind, a key non-player, is Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who we mentioned a little bit before. The president has been sniping at his attorney general for months now, accusing him of not doing his job and suggesting he go after Democrats and saying he wishes he had hired pretty much anybody else except Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions last week sniped back, saying as long as he's attorney general, you know, the Justice Department will not be politicized. Barbara, you alluded to this before, Jeff Sessions as hero of the Constitution. Do you buy it?
Yeah, I mean, Jeff Sessions doesn't want to be distracted from locking up kids on the border. I was really glad to hear him make a principled statement last week. I don't want to diminish that. But I think there will be a constitutional crisis of some sort if Sessions is removed and Rudy Giuliani is the next, or pick a name, you know.
Omarosa.
Pardon?
Omarosa.
Omarosa, yes. That would, you know, I'd almost go for that. I don't know where that goes. I'm very disoriented now by having to admire Jeff Sessions.
I mean, I think it says something that the authoritative statement that we saw from Jeff Sessions was basically, I became attorney general on the day I was sworn in. It was like, okay, whatever you need to put out there. But I do think that the Sessions is just the perfect example of why for Trump everything is personal. I mean, when you look at Sessions' actual record of being the lock him up and throw away the key attorney general that I think Trump would have wanted for the position, mm-hmm. halted sentencing reform in the Senate this year. He brought back civil asset forfeiture. He, you know, also halted the reform of phasing out private prisons on the federal level. I mean, he's checked all the boxes except for the most important one, which is remaining loyal to the president and protecting the president. So, you know, I think he's almost the ultimate example of, for Trump, really all you need to do is take care of the personal stuff and not the policy stuff.
Right.
I think Paul Ryan made the right point on a related matter a week or two ago in the New York Times Magazine. Profile they did on him. He, the president, is trolling us. He's trolling the voters, but more importantly, he's trolling the news media. And it gets back to the point that you guys were making about so much news happening on so many fronts. He knows, and he's very good because he grew up professionally, Trump did, in the maelstrom of the New York media market. Howard Stern and New York One and Page Six. I mean, that is a really venal environment in which to compete for attention. And I don't think he knows what he's going to do with Jeff Sessions, either before or after the midterms. But I think he knows that talking aloud about it sucks up enough of the news hole and the public attention that allows other things that might be more deserving of our attention to go unnoticed or less noticed. Yeah.
So top Republican senators such as Lindsey Graham and others are talking openly about Jeff Sessions being replaced after the midterm. Lindsey Graham apparently even saying basically, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. And naturally, that leads people to wonder, you know, would Mueller be fired by whoever replaces him? There was talk last week that Democrats in Congress have concocted an emergency action plan in case Mueller is fired. Now, as with most Democratic Party secret plans, it was promptly leaked to the press, and widely discussed. But the plan apparently involves trying to get Mitch McConnell to help them. Good luck. And going to those Republican members of Congress who have been saying privately they're upset with what Trump is doing and seeing if they can get them to come out in the open and not quite sure do what at that point.
Did they leak out a plan B?
Plan B was to issue some really tough press releases and to start a Facebook meme that would be insulting. If Sessions is fired, but if Mueller is fired, are we headed very quickly to a constitutional crisis, or do we muddle through to something else?
Yeah, and I think it is important to draw a distinction because I think the point was made a few moments ago that a Sessions firing would be a constitutional crisis, and it would not. Attorney generals have been fired before, and they've been fired again, and regardless if you agree or disagree with the reasoning for it. That's happened before. The Saturday Night Massacre was a horror show, but it was not a constitutional crisis because the government continued to function. A firing of Mueller, I think, on the other hand, crosses that threshold. And I think that is the point where, secret Democratic strategies notwithstanding, where you would see a number of Republicans who've tried to, you know, who've tried to keep their distance from this, realizing that they would not be able to anymore. A Mueller firing would drag a lot of them into a fray that they've been steering clear of up until now.
Yeah.
And my assumption in saying that Sessions firing would precipitate a crisis is that that would be the next thing. I mean, there would be no reason to appoint another attorney general unless that person were going to stop the Mueller investigation.
Well, before we move on to the next topic, I like the fact that someone in the audience is thinking positively, and they say, maybe something positive, the significant progress today with Mexico and NAFTA. So President Trump announced with the Mexican president on the phone that they had a breakthrough in negotiations. There was a new agreement they're going to have with Mexico. We are going to have with Mexico. He's not going to call it NAFTA. And he's looking forward to perhaps Canada joining this new thing. But I'll be honest, I didn't think they would get any breakthrough with Mexico or Canada. I thought both of those countries would probably try to stretch out the negotiations as long as possible and do it with President Pence or someone like that. Was anyone surprised by this announcement?
I mean, I love that he called it the largest trade deal of all time, which is fascinating when you go from three countries to two countries. But I think he understands the optics of this, and especially after a week like this, to come to some agreement, to get some good news out of this. I think, obviously, because this is a renegotiation within NAFTA and not a new trade deal, they're still going to need Canadians to sign on or in some way to join this deal. So I don't think it's necessarily a done deal by any stretch, but it certainly bought him 2.5 hours of positive press.
I've been an avowed free trader for many, many, many years, but I will say this, that in the last few years, thanks to Mr. Trump and Senator Sanders and others, I've become a lot more conscious than I had been and should have been throughout the 1990s and 2000s. Mm-hmm. It's easy for people like us to say free trade creates more winners than losers. Try to say that's one of the people who suffered as a result of it. And Trump and Sanders in very different ways touched a really profound chord with those voters. That said, agitating at trade deals to build political support is one thing. Destroying trade deals and causing economic devastation is another. And the greatest negative economic impact of the death or of many of these trade agreements has been on Donald Trump's political base. And while the agriculture community, while the farmers and factory workers and others have been sticking with him bravely for the reasons the guy was talking about earlier, at a certain point, not just broader economic impact, but economic targeted very specifically at his strongest group of political supporters, yeah, is not sustainable. And so while this doesn't get us very far as it relates to Europe or China or any number of other trade challenges, I think at a certain point, he has to realize that wreaking economic havoc on his most loyal supporters is not a sustainable long-term political strategy.
Dan, we are trying to be positive.
Well, not to pile on, but I just want to say, negotiating trade deals country by country is a maelstrom. I mean, you just don't want to go there. I mean, it puts the United States, in a sense, at the center of things, but you will have a nightmare down the road if you try to do it country by country. That's why previous presidents have tried to do larger trade deals.
Okay, well, I said that was the last question before we moved on. We have one more. I want to try to have a little bit of, if not equal time, more equal time for some Trump supporters. Someone writes, true or false regarding Trump, Manafort's conviction is irrelevant.
False.
False. I'll say false because I think not getting in a conviction would have been absolute disaster. I think when you look at the evidence and the accountants that they had lined up testifying in that case, to come away with that without a conviction would have been almost irreparable harm on the part of the investigation. I think they had to come away with that. And then, you know, by doing so, you just increase the pressure to have him testify. It could, you know, he still has more trials. They could still retry him on some of the initial offenses. And then, while it wouldn't be as advantageous for Manafort, they could still get a plea deal during the sentencing portion. So I think to keep the train moving forward, it was completely necessary.
Well, and the Wall Street Journal apparently is reporting that Manafort and Mueller were in negotiations for a plea deal regarding the next trial that he has coming up next month in Washington, D.C. Mueller apparently wanted more out of it than he was getting, so he didn't agree to something. But A, Manafort's exploring it.
Yeah.
And B, John Dean, former Nixon associate, turned obviously very critical of Trump. And he was saying basically, if, you know, Mueller probably wanted Manafort to give up something, you know, to be able to talk about something, and because they're not going to give a plea deal unless they know what they're getting. So we will see where that goes. That would be relevant. True or false? As far as we know, Trump committed no impeachable offenses.
Well, it's political.
That's up to the. That'd be up to.
I think we already answered that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ask again the day after the midterms.
Okay. Well, I did want to talk briefly about election insecurity. California's Secretary of State has told California political parties to be vigilant about hacking in the wake of Democratic candidates Dave Min and Hans Kierstad having their campaigns hacked. Across the country, we've had other candidates, Democratic candidates, who have said they've been targeted, including Senator Claire McCaskill. Guy, can California or local communities deal with this on their own, or does this need federal firepower?
Well, I think just on the protection of voting systems, I think, you know, California would be is already moving to fortify our own systems. There was almost $200 million in the budget towards that. But the actual voting systems is just one piece of the entire interference puzzle. I mean, when you talk about the influence of misinformation online, that's a whole other sphere that's really not being addressed at all. We talked about Senator McCain at the beginning of this program. One of the last pieces of legislation that he really pushed in the Senate was the Honest Ads Act to get more disclosure around online ads. That's moved nowhere in the Senate. And even that is just to disclose ads, to make sure that there's a level playing field between the ads you see on TV and disclosure around that and ads you see online. That doesn't get to making it harder for people to buy ads online internationally and you know, things like that. So I think we are, as a country, barely hitting the iceberg in terms of addressing these larger issues of misinformation and foreign interference.
Dan, does Governor Brown have a role in this? Or should he be criticized if our systems are hacked?
I agree with Guy, but I would draw a distinction here between two types of interference. Interference in the actual systems of voter registration and voting itself and voting tabulation is one thing. Mm-hmm. The propaganda, the communications-based interference to me is of great concern, but it's an entirely different matter. It's worth remembering that we communicated with each other before there was an internet, and we tended to spread malicious rumors in order to agitate communities for political advantage. Ben Franklin put out flyers about redcoats eating babies. And the only thing that's changed is the level of the technology and the speed with which the information is disseminated. So I'm not dismissing it, but I think the guy's first point is the voting systems themselves is where the primary focus needs to land. I give Secretary Padilla a great deal of credit. Governor Brown's not been as engaged on that as he perhaps could have.
Yeah. Okay. And I think there needs to be a federal role in this. This is, you know, California is a big state, relatively rich state, can take this on, but federally coordinated campaign and research and how to do it. It's really important.
And I would just say, too, I think, you know, the issue of misinformation, Ben Franklin, those flyers could go probably as far as, you know, he sent his kite. I think the issue today is you have countries all around the world. Russia kind of laid out the playbook, but now we're seeing, you know, Iran recently in the news last week. Facebook came forward with their, you know, attempts at misinformation. The playbook is out there, and so now I think you're just going to see more countries maybe try to tack onto that and get involved in trying to influence our voters that way.
On that happy note, let's talk about our next topic. Now, I think most of you who came here in our audience know that our new building is in an area surrounded by a lot of big tech companies. I mean, Google, Autodesk, Salesforce are all around us. Not too far away, of course, Twitter, et cetera. In fact, this influx of tech companies has both helped make San Francisco stinking rich and has been blamed for the fact that San Francisco stinks, with people forced onto the fetid streets by soaring housing prices. Those are the claims. Now, one way local politicians have found to take a whack at our new tech overlords is to go after the perks they give their employees, specifically the private food service they have for employees with free or very inexpensive food. So San Francisco's Board of Supervisors is considering changing zoning law to stop companies from having cafeterias in their buildings and instead kind of force the employees to go and use local restaurants. Barbara, I want to start with you. I mean, Mountain View, I guess, which is home to Google, did this in one big, large development there. What do you think of it?
They did well. The legality of it is tricky. I will say that when San Jose built a new city hall downtown, opened in the mid-90s or two, it's been at least 10 years, 15 years, they did not put a cafeteria in it. And it was controversial. They didn't even get the Starbucks they'd hoped for in their office space on the first floor because of some union thing, actually. So there's just a coffee kiosk in the first floor of it, and
primitive.
it's fine. It's good coffee. but everybody goes out for lunch or brings their lunch, and it's not. Across town, you have Adobe, which has been a wonderful corporate citizen in San Jose. It's very engaged in the downtown and the arts and everything else. It has a fabulous cafeteria. I've eaten there. And if I worked there, I wouldn't go out for lunch very often. I would just eat there. And I'm not even sure the food is all free there. Of course, at Google and Facebook, you get all this free food. I don't know how you change a culture to stop doing that, and I think there might be some legal issues. What do you?
I kind of see the cafeteria thing in SF as kind of a trial balloon idea. I think the larger thing we're seeing is due to the booming economy here, local governments, local politicians are feeling a lot more emboldened to take on tech companies than they were at the beginning of this decade. And beginning of the decade, San Francisco was begging companies to come and develop and begging tech companies to come in, offering the huge gross receipts tax in mid-market area to bring Twitter in. Fast forward now, we're going to have three ballot measures in November in Mountain View, East Palo Alto, here in San Francisco, taxing big businesses to pay for things like transit, homelessness. So I think the economy, and we'll see how long it lasts, but has given cities a whole new leverage to kind of take on businesses, whether it's over where their employees are eating, the taxes that they're paying. And it'll be interesting to see these corporations' responses. Because remember, the tax reform of last year, they were the huge benefactors. When you're bringing the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%, these are the companies that are coming home with a boatload of cash. And now local politicians are looking at that and saying, okay, well, we'd like to get in on that a little bit.
I give you both a lot of credit for talking about the pros and cons of this as if this were a rational proposal. Let me offer you.
We're trying to be positive here.
In this spirit, I changed my party registration from Republican to no party preference several years ago, but I still philosophically consider myself, I believe, in a government that focuses on a relatively limited number of tasks in order to accomplish them very, very well. And I still believe in doing everything you can to promote and encourage small business and entrepreneurs to succeed. But the idea of forbidding businesses from serving food to their employees to force them to go to area restaurants, I think is really just nibbling around the edges. I think we ought to outlaw refrigerators in private homes. And that way, every citizen will be forced to go out and buy food at restaurants. That's the way to solve this problem.
You have a base.
It's people like me who can't cook.
So, Guy, do you get free food at KQED?
Oh, I wish. keep those memberships coming. Maybe check back in a year. We'll see.
Well, another topic of local interest is an effort in the state legislature to give BART more power over housing decisions on land it owns. Guy, you've been following this story. What's going on?
Well, yeah. So this is, I think, just the latest iteration of this battle between local governments, many here in the Bay Area, and the state when it comes to housing. I think this has kind of been the fulcrum of, as we deal with this huge housing crisis, this huge shortage of supply, the state has tried to really wrest control from local governments in order to ramp up development. So this proposal started out really ambitious. It started out basically saying that BART would set its own housing rules, its own zoning rules on land that it owns. So BART, you know, the people that brought you Civic Center Station will be, you know, housing developers. And I think, I would say on the flip side of this, you know, many of these areas around BART, you've seen them, they're filled with parking lots. And I think the folks in the legislature who have pushed for transit-oriented development, both to build housing, build dense housing, but also cut down on greenhouse gases, people aren't commuting, build housing right near transit, this would be an obvious place to do it. So it started out as this proposal to allow BART to move forward as a developer and override a lot of the issues that have often been brought up by local city governments. Where does housing proposals go to die? It's often in, you know, suburban city councils. So this would seek to get around that. You know, in classic state legislature fashion, it's been watered down significantly. Now these developments, you know, on BART land could only be one story higher than the houses that are zoned for that area anyway. So it's not as if BART could commission these skyscrapers to come in, you know, the Concord BART parking lot or something like that. But it does get to this overall issue that you've seen the last few years and you're going to continue to see is this push and pull between state and local governments when it comes to housing.
This is where there really is a much more assertive role for a governor to play. Jerry Brown said several years ago that he considered reform of the California Environmental Quality Act to be, and I quote him, to be God's work. He's clearly decided to leave it to God to accomplish that for him. And there was legislation earlier this year that would have made it much easier for private developers to build taller multi-resident structures adjacent to transit. It was reported that the governor supported that legislation, but was not willing to say so publicly. Yeah. And not surprisingly, the legislation died. So let's agree that having more transit adjacent housing is a good thing. If the question is whether BART or some other entity be the responsible developing agent, it's a conversation to have. But the legislature had it within reach to make it easier for private developers to do just that and punted on it. And we're left with something that's a little bit less.
I mean, you make a great point. That bill was far more ambitious than this BART housing bill. Couldn't even clear a single committee. So I think that's kind of the issue that we're dealing with.
Yeah.
Barbara, go ahead.
Well, giving BART more authority to do different things seems to me not a good thing to do.
BART. Now that they've perfected transit.
Exactly. And public safety.
Yes.
BART, you know, when BART is being built into San Jose now, and we'll have a station opening, supposed to be this year, probably be next year. I hope it'll be next year. It will go up the East Bay, unfortunately, not directly up here, because San Mateo originally vetoed a BART line down, and don't get me started.
San Mateo is always the problem.
Yeah, San Mateo is always the problem. Nobody thought it was a good idea at the time. It's really sad. Anyway, when the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, when local governments, Valley Transportation Authority got together to try to plan this and start raising local money for it, it was agreed that the county, Valley Transportation Authority, would build this line, BART would not build the line. We would not join the BART system. We would then contract with BART to run the line. And it never would have happened if we were going to, if we had to become part of BART. There's not a high trust level with BART. There's so much design, there's so much importance to design in building this kind of housing, because if you do high-density housing badly in an area like this, you know, people just hate it. And if you do it well, you have something like, now it's over the top, but Santana Row in San Jose, very popular place, popular shopping, astronomically expensive housing. It's beautiful. That would be the extreme of well done. It's a very different thing. And I grew up in the East Coast, where you would see the burned out Bronx over time, you know, badly, badly, badly designed public housing, but just horrible brick buildings. And I would worry about BART not getting the design part right.
That's actually great, because the question I was literally going to ask was, would this be better received if BART wasn't perceived as being poorly managed, wrong?
Oh, absolutely. I think that plays into it a lot. Just, you know, hearing from the senators last week on the floor of the legislature, the opponents brought that up again and again. You know, this is an agency, you know, that we can't trust over labor issues and cleanliness in the stations. Why should we trust them with housing? I think that absolutely plays into it. Yeah. But I will note, you know, opponents have said, well, this is a slippery slope. You start giving BART the authority to do this. BART has a very different role, I think, that's been carved out than, say, VTA. These are still elected members. So if you disagree with what your BART board director is doing, you can Google them first and then, you know, look them up and vote them out. So I would say BART has a different role than something like Metrolink or VTA, but certainly that has come up in the opposition.
And thanks to you, probably people who are watching this in other parts of the state are right now Googling Civic Center Station. just be glad you can't smell through your computer.
It's the downside.
Let's get in a couple audience questions before we get to our news quiz. Someone writes about John McCain and says, what do you think his chances would have been if he had named Joe Lieberman as his running mate?
Well, it's been reported, of course, that Senator McCain wanted to pick Senator Lieberman as his running mate in 2008, and that he was talked out of it by many of the people who I had worked with 8 years earlier. And what they told him is they said, if you select a Democrat to be your running mate, the Republican convention delegates will not confirm him as your running mate. And Senator, you can't afford to start the general election campaign with the Republican Party in the middle of revolution. Yeah. I don't pretend to know whether that's correct or not, but I'll offer you just two thoughts on it. Particularly, and granted, Wall Street didn't collapse until, you know, sometime after the Republican convention. Mm-hmm. Let's agree that a conventional candidacy for the Republican candidate in that economic environment could not succeed. There was just no way that a nominee of the incumbent president's party was going to have any kind of chance once the economy had collapsed. So it would have required something absolutely out of the ordinary. And if anybody there had been able to see that economic collapse coming, they might have said, it's a tremendously risky thing to do, but we have to do something tremendously risky. The other thing to do, I'd say this, if you go back and watch the video in which Senator McCain announced Governor Palin as his running mate, the event in Dayton, Ohio. Go back and watch it. And after he has introduced her, watch him watch her. It is very clear, at least to me, and I don't pretend to be close with him. I worked with him for a short time many years ago. But in watching him watching her, it's fairly clear to me that he had no idea what he was getting.
Yeah.
And he had been told that she was a political reformer. And if you will listen to and read his introduction of her, that's exactly what he emphasizes. I don't believe, and I could be wrong, I don't believe that he had any idea that in addition to a reformer, he was also getting a cultural warrior. and watching that speech, even at a time, for those of you who remember, it took several days for her nomination to become more controversial. It was immediately met with a very positive response. Even before the backlash started, watch him watch her, and you can tell that this isn't what he thought he was getting himself into. And when he faced the moment, Guy, that you were talking about with the woman at his campaign rally, may have been the moment where he and a lot of other people realized that Pandora's box was not going to close back up again.
Yeah.
Briefly, anyone you know of who could assume McCain's role as a bipartisan advocate? I think we kind of touched on that, but no?
I disagree. I'm not going to I'm not going to list off names for you. Okay, I will.
That was the question.
But there are, but I think there are people in both parties who have been cowed by their party orthodoxy, and I'm very careful to say both parties, whose instincts would lead them toward the sort of political bridge building that we've been talking about earlier, but feel incapable of doing so. I would tell you this. I think if Barack Obama and John Boehner had been locked in a room together at the height of the budget crises of Obama's years, the two of them could have fashioned a very reasonable and rational solution. But neither one of them felt capable of standing up to their own respective party bases. And I don't know if that person in the Republican Party is Lindsey Graham or Ben Sasse or John Kasich or Bob Cork or any number of others. We could list off an equally long list in the Democratic Party as well. But yeah, I think there's plenty of people who can do that. The question is whether they will do that.
And I would add, you know, our governor, Jerry Brown's, when he talks about his governing philosophy as paddling a little bit to the left and a little bit to the right, I think that's in the, you know, McCain lane, so to speak. But looking at the next crop of folks, and especially in the Senate today, I don't see.
No, I don't. I mean, the whole question is, do they have the courage to do the kinds of things McCain did and said? And I'm not seeing it, but I'm not, of course, close to it. I'm on the wrong coast. So.
Well, most of the things that McCain said we can't repeat in a family program, so that's a reference to some of the saltier language he's used. So let's move on to the news quiz. If we could have maybe the lights turned up a bit, and if Fran could come up, she's going to deliver prizes to people who answer the question correctly. So I'll read a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you. You can shout it out. If you're right, Fran gives you chocolate. If you're wrong, you still had your moment in the sun, really. Okay, so the first question. Robin Leach, the star of the TV show Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, passed away last week at the age of 76. What was the name of a short-lived spin-off of that show? Did anyone see that? Do any of you know? Not a single guess, really?
Okay, this is the wrong room for that question.
Sorry, I should even do it in his accent. It was called Runaway with the Rich and Famous. So, I know, now your life is so much more enriched, right?
Yeah.
You know that. Okay, political question. The Democratic Party voted on Saturday to limit the power of whom in choosing the party's nominee? Sir, kind of back center there.
Superdelegates.
Superdelegates, that's right. Apparently Vladimir Putin is not being limited. Author Kevin Kwan could face prison in his native Singapore after it came out that this 44-year-old never performed his required national service, and though he lives overseas, he never got a valid exit permit. Kwan is the author of what book that became a movie? Sir, your hand in the third row was first. Sorry? Crazy Rich Asians, that's correct. Let's see. Spain is set to check up on Chevy Chase's old joke by exhuming whom? Right there. Ma'am, in the front row?
Franco,
that's right. Chevy Chase used to joke on Saturday Night Live. Generalissimo Francisco Franco is still dead. Pope Francis met with victims of clerical sexual abuse during a visit to what heavily Catholic country? Right there along the edge?
Ireland,
that is correct. um, Walt Disney World agreed to pay whom what? Over there, sir.
Employees better wages.
Do you know how much? I think, sorry?
$15
Yeah, their minimum wage up to 15, which was, the number mattered because that's their whole thing that they were shooting for.
I'll split the gift.
Split it.
Yes, you can share the chocolate if you want. Okay, so buzzkill scientists are saying there's no amount of what that is good for your health. Way in back, sir, your hand went right up. That is correct. There are no health benefits to drinking alcohol. Hope you enjoyed our reception.
Fake news, I see.
Fake news, okay. Let's see. A Berkeley city councilman bragged about voting to give police the biggest raise possible. Why was that a problem? Right in the front.
He had been stopped for an infraction in his moving vehicle. And he said he had to establish his credentials so he would not be targeted as a victim.
That's right. He said this to the police officer who pulled him over for running a red light. He also called the police officer's boss, Berkeley's police chief. So that looks good. Let's see. A new study shows that aspirin might help avoid a second heart attack, but it doesn't help what? Sir in the blue.
Prevent the first heart attack.
Doesn't help you prevent the first heart attack. That is what they're finding. I know. Aspirin, alcohol, yeah. It's like, what is there? Okay, two more. Kelly Ward, she's running for the GOP primary to replace Senator Jeff Flake in Arizona. She suggested that the impending death and media coverage of John McCain might have been designed to do what? Ma'am, your hand was up before I was even done.
Cue her campaign.
I'll give it to you.
Purposely sell it.
Right, that it was that the death and the news about the stopping medical treatment was done to halt or to downplay the beginning of her bus tour. That's Kelly Ward, the future senator from Arizona, probably. Okay, after an intra-party leadership switch, Scott Morrison is the new prime minister of what country? Ma'am, right in the front. Australia, that is correct. Well, we'll have more news quiz questions and obviously a lot more to talk about in 2 weeks on Monday, September 10th for our next week-to-week here in San Francisco. You can find our week-to-week news quiz on our website. Thanks to our great panel today, Barb Marshman, Guy Marzorati, and Dan Schnur. Thanks to all of you for being here in the room, everyone listening and watching online. Have a great week.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of Week to Week from the Commonwealth Club of California, airing on the Michelle Meow Show on the Progressive Voices Network. I'm John Zipperer, and you can join us Thursdays when I co-host with Michelle before a live audience at the Commonwealth Club in downtown San Francisco. Join us for an upcoming program and find out more about the club and how you can become involved at commonwealthclub.org/MMS.